Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. I'm chatting with John Kaiser, founder and editor of Kaiser Research. Now, John, you and I have been talking a lot recently about rare earths, that sector that is getting a bit more attention, and some of the stocks are getting some more money flowing into them. We do still see some of these rare earth stocks, which are not that many of them in the whole scheme of things. They have been doing better. But there's a bigger picture aspect here, narrative that is really creeping into investors' heads, and that is this electrification movement. Or green initiative, we could say, that has brought a few other metals and resources, commodities that really have not been on people's radar. They're smaller sectors, but we've seen price appreciation and we've seen more companies even created in these sectors because, well, you and I both know there are certain trend followers out there that when they see some news perk up in one area of the commodity sector, they start up those companies. What's your first, just broad look and thought on this narrative that the world is moving now more quickly towards an electrification in this green initiative?
I think this is a very significant trend. In the past week, we heard America's biggest car company, GM, declare that their goal is by 2035 to no longer be producing combustion engine cars. And that was a bit of a shock because that's only 15 years down the road to be no longer producing our traditional gasoline cars. That's a very big statement. And it ties in with the November election, the shift to the Biden presidency, and its acceptance that climate change is a significant problem. We have to do what we can to keep the temperature growth from below 1.5 to maximum 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2050. And this creates all kinds of new demands for materials that go into these technologies related to the green economy. And you mentioned the rare earth sector, and I think we're on the verge of rare earth mania 2.0 kicking in. A couple of weeks ago, China floated a legal proposal for comment about finally consolidating the rare earth industry and making it much more orderly. And this does not apply to the big light rare earth mines, the Bayan-Obo mine or the Mani-Yuping mine. These produce their huge amounts of neodymium, praseodymium, also lanthanum and cerium from these large, properly run mines. These are not affected. What is affected are these small ion adsorption clay deposits that there's many of them in southeastern China. They tend to be run by small organizations, many of them criminal organizations. They pay no attention to downstream emissions. They wastefully produce these resources. These are not the type of resource where you just dig deeper to get more of it. These are surficial weathering products. When you skim this scab off the earth, there's fresh rock underneath that you cannot mine for these heavy rare earths. And the key ones, terbium and dysprosium, they're essential to the permanent magnets, which are mainly made of neodymium and praseodymium, the light rare earths. But these other two, terbium and dysprosium, when you dope the magnet with them, that keeps them from losing their magnetism under high operating temperature. And as everybody contemplates the electric vehicle build-out happening a lot faster, there is now concern, well, will China even have enough rare earths, especially these heavy rare earths that are produced only in China for building out its own fleet? And what is the rest of the world, all the car makers, going to do to secure this supply? And in the last 2 days, yttrium, which is the most abundant heavy rare earth and for which the applications pretty much faded away in the past decade because of new lighting technology displacement, it has jumped from about $3 a kilo to $4.25 all in one shot. And that is the main byproduct of these ion absorption clay deposits in China. I think this is already reflecting the crackdown. There's no new demand for yttrium. Terbium and dysprosium have been rising since November as demand for this input for the electric vehicles grew. Now we're seeing yttrium go up because the disruption in the supply of these heavy rare earths is probably finally going to become reality after the Chinese talked about it for the past 6 years.
John, do we need to be aware of any substitution risk for any of these metals or resources as prices rise, even though they do seem to be rising broadly?
Well, during Rare Earth Mania 1.0 in 2010 to 2011, something like yttrium went up to $200 a kilo. It's now only $4 a kilo. Dysprosium and terbium went into the, terbium case went into the thousands, dysprosium up in towards $1,000 a kilo. And that unleashed huge thrifting in the rare earth sector. These permanent magnets are used in lots of parts of the cars. And what happened was that when they became so expensive, all the little things that make your windows roll up and that, they went and used bulkier, more traditional ferrite magnets, you know, iron-type magnets for that. They had to keep using it for the key parts of the electric engine propulsion system. But in these many of these other areas, they simply substituted where it wasn't necessary. But with electric vehicles, weight is a key problem because the killer is how long can you ride with the charge that you have. So you want to keep the weight of everything down. So there's a desire to move back to the permanent magnets. And in the case of dysprosium and terbium, there was a lot of R&D put into thrifting it, using less and less of it, you know, manipulating it into the permanent magnets so that you didn't need as much of it. And then they got a bonus because the prices of these heavy rare earths collapsed lower than they were before the run-up in 2010. So there is a lot of room for these heavy rare earths to increase in price, not to crazy levels that they were in 2010, but substantially above the current levels without harming the cost effectiveness of using these in this material. But there will be physical shortages. It's like the problem we have with car makers having to shut down production because they're not getting the chips because they're simply not being made enough in Taiwan. And then you add on top of that the problem that, you know, China wants to annex Taiwan and make it formally part of itself. The entire semiconductor industry is based in China, and it's not like the supply is being physically suppressed. It takes time to build these foundries, to get them up and running. And everybody's realizing we need to shift that to North America, build these foundries there and not have it in this vulnerable location. And it's the same thing with these heavy rare earth supply. We now need to think beyond these clay deposits in China, where even the Chinese are cracking down on it and going to have their own problem. And this is the key thing to start thinking about, getting supplies from elsewhere in the world, being able to sell them to manufacturers with ESG credentials, because in your jurisdiction, you have tough environmental regulations, you have a monitoring enforcement system. You don't really have any of that in China, even if they pass this law. Nobody will believe anything that comes out of China because there simply isn't a journalistic tradition that has been allowed to evolve and to exist, which can criticize the system for abuses of what are supposed to be the rules. So anything that comes out of China will always have the stigma of it's dirty. You can attach whatever ESG credentials that you want, but we don't trust anything out of China. And that differentiation between the China price good and the good made in ESG certified jurisdictions, that's going to be a major factor going forward for what counts as the price that you will be able to achieve for whatever metal you're going to produce.
So what about any news out of the U.S. government? Because that is one thing that has spurred especially a lot of the moves in stocks that are focused in North America broadly, is that the government will continue to step in and try to, I guess, secure domestic supply. Anything else that you're watching closely for U.S. government moves?
Well, these U.S. government measures, I mean, until 1990, they had a stockpiling program, which started after World War II, where they would buy these metals, make sure that they had a stockpile in case there was an external disruption. That was during the Cold War. They're talking about doing that, but it's kind of silly because they're going to have to buy it from these other jurisdictions. They talk about making money available to support R&D and this and that, but that's kind of meaningless also. What they really have to work on is to look at their permitting cycle, because there's still a disconnect. Yes, we want rare earths, we want uranium, we want copper, we want all this, but the permitting cycle for even simple exploration, drilling holes, it is so protracted and inefficient that they're just blowing smoke by talking about we need this self-sufficient. They need to get the permitting process fixed up, not make it be this obstructionist thing that it mutated into during the past couple of decades when globalization ruled, where he said, yeah, mine it in Africa, mine it in China, mine it anywhere else in the world, but here we'll just buy it from the cheapest place out there. We'll turn a blind eye to all the pollution and downstream misery caused by those operations. But let's keep America clean and pristine while we sully the rest of the world. And this structure that's embedded, it needs to be unwound, not have the standards reversed or anything like that, but have everything made much clearer and simple so that the companies know what it is that they need to comply with. And now that we have this possibility of things like the ABAX exchange, where material that is ESG certified can actually be offered in an auction market so that buyers, manufacturers can buy it. And when they turn around to their consumers and say, our ESG rating for our Tesla is so-and-so, the consumer won't turn around and say, BS, you're just greenwashing. You're just making this stuff up, trying to make us feel good when we buy your product. No, verifiability through information technology is now becoming part of this entire new manufacturing and raw material supply situation.
So, John, what I'm taking away from here is that, look, this is a trend that is here and sounds like it's going to stay for a while, but there's still a lot of work to do, especially in terms of developing North American supply and broadly that market. So does that mean that we might see a bit of a lull in this whole electrification or green movement? Maybe it takes a couple more years before the next big run-up happens?
Well, one of the big issues now is the relationship between the United States and its allies and China. Under the Trump administration, it was intensified. It became more fraught with conflict. We do have a competition between China and the United States in terms of which is going to be the biggest economy in the world. There's also the issue of eventual military supremacy. There's this question of space. China now has the ability to wreck its own satellites in orbit, which, yeah, you can do that, except you shouldn't, because all those bits and pieces will end up taking out all the other satellite systems. So there's this big conflict that needs to be dialed back. China and the United States need to get along, but they can't forget that they are now major economic competitors, and they need to both work together to ensure that for common goals, such as the electrification of the transportation industry, the materials are available for everybody. We don't end up having part of the world give up and say, okay, we're just going to stick with gasoline engines because we simply don't have that material available. Now, in the case of China, they really don't like gasoline because they don't have any oil. They have to import it from elsewhere, and that is a vulnerability for them. They are pushing into the electric vehicle fleet build-out because they have plenty of coal that they can burn. They also have places they can source uranium from to build their nuclear power reactors to generate the electricity, which would be better than burning coal. But they don't have to really care about the clean stuff, except in the long run, if your ambition is to become the greatest nation ever, what's the point of achieving that if the global temperature has risen, you know, several degrees and all the climate systems have become discombobulated and parts of your country are underwater and other ones have drought and nothing works properly anymore because you've allowed the global climate thing to slip into runaway territory, you know, tipping points where things like suddenly the ice sheets melt really rapidly or the permafrost suddenly thaws super fast and releases all the frozen methane and that in there and completely accelerate all these, global climate scale changes that we're currently worrying about.
All right, John, final comment. I want to dive a bit more into one metal, that is copper. And copper gets lumped into almost every argument when it comes to economic restarts, but then also it is getting tied into this whole electrification initiative. Copper has been rising. People are bullish on copper. How much is copper dependent on this continued move to a green economy?
Well, copper has historically, they talk about Dr. Copper, how copper's doing is a sign of how the macro economy is doing. Obviously, last year was a disaster because of the pandemic lockdown. When we get past the pandemic, and we're already seeing this in China, there will be not just a recovery stimulus, but what's happening with this whole clean energy thing is it's an opportunity to rethink the entire nature of the infrastructure, not just bring it back, but make it better. There's this phrase running around called "build it back better." So the COVID period, with its will probably be longer than another year of hurting the bottom lines of companies. It'll allow an elevated market prices to persist a lot longer, because it wasn't any company's fault that they ended up having lower revenues and therefore profitability, and therefore the stocks should have tanked to reflect the lower PE ratios. So they probably have at least another year or so of being allowed these ridiculous high PE ratios without triggering a massive sell-off. And if underneath this comes fiscal stimulus in the form that rebuilds infrastructure and especially continues to support the electrification of transportation, that's going to be really good for copper. That will build on top of the economy getting back onto its normal growth trajectory. And keep in mind, the past decade was not a great period for finding and building new mines. Yes, there were a whole bunch that got rolling as a result of the super cycle in the first decade of this century, but these have now all been built. Companies have had to deal with sideways copper prices for some time. So there's this built-in supply-demand lag into the raw materials sector. The mining industry always remembers the punishment from the most recent punishment it suffers. Right now, yes, they all like to talk about copper as the green metal of the future, but they're also worried about that copper, didn't keep going to $5 and beyond, and might just stay here at $3.50 for a while. And they quite happy to collect the cash flow that comes from this. And if copper does spike to $5-6 a pound, well, then they'll get serious about it and say, okay, the EV build-out, all this stuff is real. The electrical grid's being rewired and redone. There are way more charging stations needed to keep all these cars juiced up with electricity. Then they'll start being a build-up. And for people like myself who follow the resource juniors, this inevitably will lead to another period of elevated metal prices, in particular copper. So we could see copper end up in that $4 to $6 range, with people saying, oh, it's going to go to $10, $12 a pound or so. But the real question is $4 to $6 a pound going to be the new reality for copper? And something to keep in mind is we are always innovating in how to use materials more efficiently. So we suddenly have a new higher raw material price. So we figure out how to how to alloy cheaper materials with it, make it do more work for the price that it is. This innovation part in materials science, this is a big thing going on in the background, and that will help to sustain elevated metal prices in the longer run.
All right, John, we're wrapping it up there. Thanks for really diving into this discussion and facing head on some of these other metals that are flying still under the radar and quite frankly could have some torque on the upside as long as this narrative does continue to develop. If anybody has any further questions or anything else that you want to hear John's insights on, please email me fleck@kereport.com. I'll forward those on to John and also record some interviews on the back end of those questions. John, great chatting with you this week, buddy. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Corey. You're welcome.